Talk Back with Gary Nall, Sundays at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, there will be no guest. There will be a commentary of my own original writing, Full Speed Ahead, In the Wrong Direction. And I'm going to ask you to think about what I'm saying, see if you can relate to it, and call in after I share it with you and give your points of view. It's part of our issue, part of our program. The latest on health and healing, including some common spices that work better than aspirin to stop blood clots. Also, a special commentary by William Falloon on the FDA. They're saying now that cherries and walnuts and pomegranate are illegal drugs. How do you figure? We'll discuss it. Let's begin. A lot of people take aspirin each day because they've been told that it will thin the blood. It will. And that it's going to help prevent a heart attack or stroke. It won't prevent a heart attack, but it could prevent a stroke if the cause of the stroke is because of a aggregation of your red blood cells that then create clots. So as a result, yes, it would definitely prevent some strokes. But the side effects are devastating. Each year, at least 24,000 Americans die because of ulcerations in the intestine and bleeding in the stomach because of those aspirin or other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. For example, Vioxx killed 60,000 Americans. And yet, you would think that we would review all COX-2 inhibitors that thin the blood. We didn't. That turn off pain. We don't. So then what can help us prevent a stroke, but natural? That's not going to cause side effects. Won't cause bleeding. Won't destroy vitamin C and vitamin K and vitamin B6. Spices. Spices, they're easy to get. They're inexpensive. And according to the Central Food Technological Research Institute, they evaluated the effect of spices such as capsaicin, piperine, quercetin, curcumin, and cinnamaldehyde, and allyl sulfide on human plated aggregation. Now, all these are natural. And what they found was that each compound evaluated was able to significantly inhibit blood clotting. Furthermore, the compounds perform their antiplatelet aggregation activity against several different factors that promote the clotting of blood. Red pepper, cayenne pepper, the active ingredient is called capsaicin, C-A-P-S-A-I-C-I-N. You also have what is called eugenol, E-U-G-E-N-O-L. Now, these are the most potent inhibitors of arachidonic acid. Where do you get arachidonic acid? Every time you eat meat. Bologna, salami, steaks, pork chops, hot dogs, hamburgers, all that creates arachidonic acid. That's a bad thing because arachidonic acid causes platelets to aggregate, clump together. So this ability was shown by the other tested compounds in the declining order of curcumin, and cinnamaldehyde, piperine, allyl sulfide, you're getting that from garlic, and quercetin, you get that from oranges and onions. And eugenol was found to be 2,900% more potent than aspirin, inhibiting arachidonic acid and induced human platelet aggregation. both eugenol and capsaicin inhibit production of clotting factors in dose-dependent manner. So this is all good news, and this was all published in Prostaglandins, Leukotrienes, and Essential Fatty Acids, the journal. So powerful spices that we should have at all times, and I would suggest just making up a little natural medicine cabinet, especially if you have a history of having any form of high blood pressure or any type of stroke. This could help save your life. Global food production plummets. This is a chart that I read this morning, and it says global food production is expected to plummet between 20 and 40% in upcoming periods of time. Now, when you consider 40%, that means that at least 2 million individuals will be without food that they could afford. We don't seem to be doing anything about it in the United States. In fact, we're doing just the opposite. Very rich soil in North Dakota, Montana, South Dakota, is being devoted to raising corn for ethanol instead of raising food for humans. We've got to get away from ethanol, and we've got to get back into proper sustainable agriculture. Because sooner or later, that ability not to feed ourselves is going to come to the United States. Oh, did we forget an issue that no one is discussing? The fact that 49 million Americans go to bed hungry each day. 12.7 million are children. Why do you think the Democrats and Republicans won't talk about this? Why do you think that you don't hear this discussed on MSNBC or Fox or anywhere else? Because once you show the problem and you show how widespread it is and you show how long it's been there and how it's growing, how food banks have run out of food. They don't have enough food for the people in need. In fact, recently I was down in Camden, New Jersey, considered the poorest city in the United States, and they'd already laid off half their police department. And I was at the Sacred Heart Church, where Reverend Michael McDowell, who was on the Camden 7, which was back in the Vietnam War in a protest movement, where he is the priest. While we were there, he made an interesting comment about how little food they're getting compared to how many people are requesting food. And he said, you know, not a single journalist, Diane Sawyers, came down to film what we're doing, because he's doing an awful lot, and he's just one person. And yet he found an abandoned storefront and got the owner of the building to turn it over so he could make a theater. And so he, in his neighborhood, he's converted a lot of these buildings into things people can actually use and benefit from. Plus, this school is terrific. And the archdiocese gives him no money because he won't stick by their strict principles. He teaches people of all backgrounds, all races, and he doesn't start up with the idea that they have to be Catholic or they're going to be taught Catholicism. So he's really a unique person. And so he says, no one in the media who's ever filmed me has ever given a single thing back. And I thought about that all the way back to New York. And also while we were filming out on the street, this car kept coming up twice and said, you got to get out of here. And I said, why? It's the middle of an afternoon. He says, you don't understand. This is one of the highest crime rate cities in America. And when they see that you're out here, they're going to take your camera. They'll sell it for drugs. I said, well, how are we going to tell the story if we're not out here? How can we show the problem of the people if we don't talk with the people? I said, that's like talking about a war without going into the war zone and talking with the people who are actually there and the victims of it. So anyhow, we went ahead and we filmed all day. We had no problems. Went into a lot of people's homes. And the one thing they continued to say was, it's interesting when you watch television and you see what America's interest is. Accumulation, possessions, fame. And here we are with nothing. Woman showed me she had no running water. Another person that had a fire a year before and there was still a hole in the roof because there was no money to get it fixed. So you haven't seen bad in America. You've been to Camden, New Jersey. It really is worth going there. It's right across the river from Philadelphia. In fact, you see Philadelphia's skyline from Camden. And there was a time when Camden was a vital city. It had great manufacturing, ships mainly. It was one of the major shipbuilding centers in the United States. But all that was a long time ago, and now it's got poverty, hunger, homelessness, crime, and more than anything, apathy. Needless to say, the next day when I got back, I sent a truckload of food over there. It's just that one food truck is not going to feed a whole lot of people for very long. And I just was thinking all the way back, how is it that we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars per day in these worthless, useless wars, and yet Americans are starving? Makes no sense. Anyhow, next up, stopping diabetes damage with vitamin C. This is from Science Daily, and this is from the researchers at Harold Hamm Oklahoma Diabetes Center. They found a way to stop the damage caused by type 1 diabetes with the combination of insulin and a common vitamin, vitamin C. And when they were used separately, they didn't work as well as when they were used in combination to control blood sugar swings. And what happened was the vitamin C helped stop the blood vessel damage caused by diabetes and who have poor glucose control. Quote, "We had tested this theory on research models, but this is the first time anyone has shown the therapy's effectiveness in people." That's according to the director of the Medical Department of Cell Biology. So vitamin C, if you're diabetic, and this was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Are you taking your multiple vitamins? If you are, you're on the right side of science and history, because it's linked to younger biological age. National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences discovered that cells from individuals who take a multiple vitamin have a younger biological age than cells from individuals who don't take a multiple vitamin. And why? Well, what you've heard me discuss many times on this program is that at the end of your chromosomes are little caps. Those caps are like the little end of a shoestring that keeps it from unraveling. Those are called telomeres. And DNA sequences at the end of chromosomes that shorten as cells replicate and age are directly measurable by your telomeres. So the aging and lifespan of normal, healthy cells are linked to the telomerase shortening. So then the idea is, what can we do to shorten it? Well, let's go back to the 1970s. Back then, I was a junior young scientist at the Institute of Biology. I also was with Tervaga Hospital helping out with their drug addiction program. And the director of the Institute of Biology was also the president of Tervaga Hospital. So I was in a unique position to try some therapies. And he always said, do this quietly, because if the board finds out, the board of trustees and the board of governors, they'll say, well, what are you doing? There's no other science to back it up. And he said his answer would be, well, of course there's not. But there was no science to back up the light bulb till it was invented, the telephone till it was invented. The idea that because reality supersedes scientific verification is not even thought about by these people. He was really always angry at the idiots, the other scientists who were there, because, man, were they orthodox. They were all into trying to discover the next chemotherapy cure or something for mental illness cure, which they never did, and wasted a whole lot of money. But this all happened because of one of those little flukes. I had a best-selling book. It was called The Complete Handbook of Nutrition. And there was a woman who had uncontrolled diabetes. She was the niece of the director. And she came to me one day. She said, I've come to a couple of your lectures, but I didn't have a chance to come and talk with you. Do you think that you could help me with my diabetes? Because she said, I'm on 5 medications. I'm now being told I got kidney problems. And I don't like what's happening to me. I said, sure. So I put her on a protocol. And I said, I'm only going to see you once. So please pay attention. Everything you need, I'll give you. But you have to make sure that you keep on the protocol. She promised she would. Now, because she worked at the institute as an assistant to the director, when her blood sugar within 3 weeks normalized, her resting fasting level blood sugar was about 190. That's really high. That means that she'd be dead today without question. Kidneys are going to go, blindness. And yet she was on multiple medications. So then the director calls me in. I hadn't met him yet. And he said, what exactly did you do to help my niece? So I went through the protocol, and he said, but there's no science in this. I looked. I said, no, there isn't. Nothing I do has any science behind it. And he said, why is that? I said, sir, with all due respect, you're here with this big institute and all these scientists. Have you discovered anything yet that really makes a difference in people's lives? And he was taken aback by that. I said, all of science today, in my opinion, is misdirected because it starts off with the assumption that all you have to do is follow what anyone else does and improve upon it to come up with your results. Well, look at all the work in cancer. They haven't done a damn thing with cancer, and that's your specialization here. And they haven't done anything with heart disease or diabetes or arthritis or depression. They haven't helped anything except for acute disease and trauma. So if you get your hand cut or you get poked in the eye, your teeth knocked out, if you have a heart attack, yeah, then there's some good things you can do. So I had this argument with him, and he was somewhat taken aback, and he said, can you put this to the test? I said, sure. He said, I'll tell you what, very quietly, because I started talking about what I thought all disease was caused from. And he said, but there's no basis in science. I said, that's correct until someone creates it. And I said, but that's how I'm an inventor. And I showed him my inventions, charts of them. And he was kind of interested in this because he turned out to also be an inventor. He invented RevioIL when he was in Hungary, where he was born. So anyhow, I took a small group of rats, and I divided them into three, and they all came from the same batches. They were all identical, but in one of the group, they were given standard rat chow. Another group, they were given supplements along with this. In a third group, they were given raw foods, no water, just juices made every day, and then they could have an unlimited environment to run around in. We did this up on the third floor because nobody even went up there. It was for storage, and we cleaned it out. At the end of 1 year, all the rats eating standard rat chow were dead. The rats that were given supplements and rat chow lived about another 2 months. But the group that was given raw foods, organic and raw juices like wheatgrass juice and apple juice and grape juice, fresh made, and had a wonderful environment to run around in, they lived almost 30% longer. That got his attention. He says, you're doing something that hasn't been done yet. This, by the way, was before Dr. Roy Warfer did his groundbreaking work out at UCLA. He got credit for this. I didn't, but I was ahead of him by 7 years. In any case, I did over 100 experiments. That's when I was invited to be a part of this, but very quietly. And my work was really on how do we slow down the cells from dividing. And then I came up with this concept that I've been building on ever since, and I'm still building on it. And that is, first you can do no harm, meaning don't put anything that we know speeds up telomerase and the division of the cells. French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, pizzas, colas, coffee, artificial sweeteners, pesticides, alcohol, environmental toxins, and stress do all of that. On the other hand, de-stressing by whatever technique, clean water, lots of juices, lots of good antioxidants, in particular antioxidants, healthy, healing, functional foods, meaning they function in the body in a specific way, and then compensation, meaning take something in a concentrated amount that's known to repair the DNA and lengthen the telomere Ah, but hold on. We were never told telomeres could be lengthened. Science said you can never grow a new brain cell. You can never grow a new heart cell. They were right. They didn't until it was done. Now we know there's a whole new science that has virtually revolutionized how we're looking at the human body. You still have dinosaurs in medicine and science because the research grants come automatically. We waste all this money, hundreds of billions of dollars we waste, of giving people who are, quite frankly, incapable of finding anything relevant, but they're connected. They're in the I can't fail because I'm in the circle of success. Their success is someone got them in this circle, and you fail up, not out. So they're never questioned each year when they get these enormous grants and continue to do the same work everyone else has and come up with no good results. But there are a lot of good innovative scientists, and as there are good innovative healers in medicine and chiropractic and naturopathic and holistic nursing and therapeutic touch. Energy is energy. If you master how you can exchange this energy, you're on to a very important element. So anyhow, I started to see that we can actually lengthen the telomeres. We can slow down the aging process, and actually we can reverse it. You reverse it when you concentrate the phytonutrients at a very high level. Very high. And I'm finding it even higher than what I had even anticipated myself, kicks into a whole nother rejuvenation process. So now imagine where we are at, where we have been, and they come along and they do this study, and it goes into a peer-reviewed journal done at the done out the University of California, San Francisco, where they link telomeres to the ends of shoelaces. That's how they liken them, without which the lace would unravel. So now they're saying, ooh, with each replication of telomeres, they shorten. And when the telomeres are totally consumed, the cells are destroyed. Hence, programmed death. Well, now we know that oxidative stress, which it comes from, guess what? Exercise. What does that mean? It means that exercise creates strong muscles, healthy lungs, lowers your resting pulse, helps bring down blood pressure, helps detoxify the body, and it ages you prematurely. Let me emphasize that again. It speeds up your death. How else can I put this? It puts you in the box or the urn quicker. How else can I get this into your head? If you just exercise and you do not compensate, you are shortening your life because you are engaged in substantial oxidative stress, which creates chronic inflammation. And that's a rough one for people to get. But I thought exercise was so good. It is. But it releases these wonderful hormones, endorphins, which allow me to feel good. It does. But now you're saying, yeah, let me explain this. When I was trying to intentionally stress my body, since I've never smoked or drank or taken any drugs or eaten garbage, I wanted to create oxidative stress at a very high level, at a level that if I were to smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day without smoking 3 packs, the only way I could do that was excessive track and field. Now, 2 things happen simultaneously, and this is where you have to listen very carefully because it sounds like a contradiction. It is not. Then it sounds like it's a paradox. It is. During an 81-week period, I raced over 80 times. I won every race that I was in my age group, or overall. I set almost 30 American records, some of which still exist today, a couple world records. I did 7 marathons in 9 weeks. I did the first L.A. marathon. I brought back a gold in the marathon. I did the first London marathon, Marine Corps marathon, Jamaica marathon, Waterfront marathon, Jersey Shore marathon, Montreal marathon. It was a lot of fun because we were doing the first, and a whole group of us would travel and do these marathons. It was like a party for us. Great shape. Hard workouts. but I was also putting in about 100 to 125 miles a week of serious training. Serious training, I'll tell you how serious it was. We'd be out there, Franco Pantone, my buddy who trained with us, and Frank Gallo. And I remember once we were whipping around the park, and I looked down at my watch, and I started it at the mile mark, and then up Heartbreak Hill. And that's a hard hill. That's real steep. We were just having a good time, and it was at a 527 mile. I think we were in our 14th mile. I don't know what we had done the previous one, but we were that strong and that fast because we did excessive training, stairs, VersaClimber, etc. There was a guy who would run around the reservoir every morning, same exact time, 13 miles, at a six-minute pace. He didn't waver 5 seconds. And sometimes I'd be out there and we'd run together. And I asked him, I said, are you racing? He said, no. I said, then why are you doing this? Because all you have to do is 3 miles a day. That's it, 3 miles a day of a good aerobic workout, like either power walking or running, to keep yourself in excellent physical shape and cardiovascular shape. Why 13 miles? He said, well, that's what I've gotten used to and it's easy on me. I said, it's easy today, but there will be a point in the future where you will have prematurely aged your whole musculoskeletal system. You won't be able to do this anymore, and you will prematurely age. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, what are you now? About 23, 24, he said, I'm 25. I says, by the time you hit 50, your body will be 100 biologically. You won't look it, but you won't have the energy, you won't have the strength, you won't have the stamina. And he just laughed. He says, nonsense. I said, okay, but that's the area of research I do. So at the end of this period of time, I found that one day, and it was just a week after I did the Empire State Games and won a gold, everywhere I went in the world, I'd win. And I went out to do a short little 5K race, 3.1 miles, at the half-mile mark, where I'd normally be flying at a low five-minute pace, 5:05. I had no energy. I had no energy at all. So I finished the race, terrible time. And I immediately got a blood sugar done. I got every hormone checked, adrenaline. Everything was completely normal. And I'm thinking, how in the world did I go from being so full of energy to no energy at all? This happened for the next 3 weeks until finally I just took a break from running. And it was only when I was doing this meditation that I realized what had happened. I had exhausted not my mitochondria or adrenaline. I'd exhausted my chi, my essential life force. Now, there's only one chi. There's a lot of people who are foolishly suggesting, oh, we have 10, 20, 30 different chis. We don't. We have one. We have one vital life force from which we divide that into segments depending upon what we need, and a wise person uses it to balance their life. You give to health. You give to relationships. You give to creativity, intellectual pursuit, spiritual pursuit, physical pursuit. In other words, you do the things with that energy that help maintain balance in your life, always in a positive way. It took me almost a year to get my chi back. And then I had learned my lesson. I had studied my biochemistry. But it taught me something about premature aging. That, yes, you will have a strong body. Yes, you'll have an outstanding biochemistry. But no one ever measures your telomeres or oxidative stress levels, because they're looking at your overall blood chemistry. They're not looking at your aging process. Now, the greatest, without question, the greatest woman long-distance runner in the world was Greta Weitz. She died last year. Young. And you look at all the one-time great athletes who didn't believe in nutrition, didn't believe in compensation, and they're all prematurely aged. Now, let's jump ahead 15 years. I'm walking down by Lincoln Center, and I run into Dennis. Hey, Gary, what's happening? I says, oh, Dennis, you look great. How are you feeling? Not so good. What's wrong? Oh, you know, my knees hurt, my legs. I just don't have that strength and energy anymore. Okay, so Dennis is 40. His biochemistry is probably 80. That's what happens when you create oxidative stress. Now, how do you get the benefit of exercise without having the negative effect of oxidative stress? Simple. Antioxidants. Antioxidants in supplement, yes, and antioxidants in functional foods also. The two together trap the free radicals that are created by oxidative stress and neutralize them so you don't have the problem. Now you have a double positive. You get all the benefits of exercise, providing you're not overdoing it, and then you get none of the side effects of oxidative stress because you're trapping the free radicals. That's why taking your vitamin C and E and tocotrienols and all the other antioxidants after you exercise, right after you exercise, that's what gives you the difference. And they've just come up with this on their own, using relatively small amounts of nutrients, but at least they're acknowledging that the telomere length is a mark of our biological age. That's the single most important measurement in your body. What is your biological age? How much oxidative stress are you under? That'll determine how long any system in your body will live. And that's where you're most susceptible. So it's important you take your antioxidants. It's very important you take your compounded powders at high levels because that's what's repairing the DNA, lengthening the telomeres, and creating new mitochondria and protecting the DNA within the mitochondria. Now, over to your calls in a moment, but first I'm going to do a commentary. This is a commentary I wrote while I was on a plane. I'm traveling now and filming. And because I travel alone, I have a lot of time to think and be introspective. I have a whole series of commentaries this week. In fact, every day this week, I'll be doing a different commentary I've written. This I call Full Speed Ahead in the Wrong Direction. And this is specifically one that I'm addressing to the Y generation, to the younger generation in our society. On November 30th, 2011, British police made 153 arrests during student demonstrations in London. Why? This is the first demonstration because they were raising university tuitions by as much as 35%. So they were protesting. On January 27th, an Egyptian wrote about the ongoing protests in our country. She said, "It's the young of the country who are leading us. They've had enough of unemployment, deteriorating education, corruption, police brutality, and political impotence. As it is now well known, they organized Tuesday's protest. They organized protest from Azuit in the south, also in the Sinai and Alexandria and the Suez and other cities, the length and breadth of Egypt. For Cairo, young activists started their march in nearby areas, collected a following, and by the time they reached, for example, Arab League Street, there were 20,000 strong marching, all students. As noted on January 18, 2011, MTV's show called Skins got off to a decent start on Monday with 3.3 million total viewers. Skins is a key part of MTV's push for finding a scripted show that can connect with its target young audience. And so think about the differences between the youth of Egypt, the youth of Tunisia, and all of those other countries, and England. They're fighting for democracy. They're demanding a just economic system. They're opposing dictatorships or corrupt governments. They're, and it was simultaneously what seemed to be occupying the mind of American youth. We're focusing on drug taking, sex, and partying. It would be unfair to make a lot of the contrast of what youth do in other countries versus our own, except I haven't seen any of these mass protests in the United States. I haven't seen mass protests among the 10.2 million homes that have been foreclosed on, and there's an average of four people per home, and two of those people are going to be kids. You're talking about then 20 million kids who've been made homeless in the last 3 years. Surely, being homeless and couch surfing or living in someone's garage basement or in an extra room is worthy of a protest, if for no other reason than to protest foreclosures. How about the student loans? Protesting the fact that you can be arrested if you don't pay them back and you can't get out them with bankruptcy. The banks made sure of that. In the moment, I'm looking at the evidence and I just see a lackluster spirit of today's youth, and not only of them, but the bulk of our country's citizenry. But first, I want to share a symbolic instance. A few years ago, one Sunday, I invited a young friend to see a documentary film, Union Maids. It's an uplifting film about the struggle for justice, delving into the lives of women who worked as organizers for the auto workers union in the 1930s, and chronicling the tremendous obstacles they overcame fighting for underpaid factory operatives. It's a moving film, and my friend was in tears after seeing it. But that's not the point. There were about 20 people in the audience, which was shown free in a union hall. Everyone there but my friend was middle-aged. And as we walked back to the subway, we passed about 40th Street and 7th Avenue in Manhattan, a huge block-long line, almost exclusively teenagers and 20-somethings, leading up to a staircase, and this Times Square neighborhood is usually deserted on weekends. So this line made me curious. So then I spotted someone in my radio audience that I knew, and I asked, what's happening here? This guy said, my son begged me to wait in line. The new Iron Man comic book is coming out, and the illustrator is signing autographs. Okay, fair enough. $20 was what they were charging. Again, I wasn't learning anything new, but this rough juxtapositioning, middle-aged people attending a film that taught about our history and affirmed the importance of working for change, and a crowd of young people queuing up for hours to have a brush with a low-level celebrity, one they had to pay top dollar for, was saddening and disquieting. Was it always like this? Were American youth always frivolous while people at middle age grew more thoughtful and questioning? Not on your life. Let's go back to February 1st, 1960, in a segregated town, Greensboro, North Carolina. The previous night, Joseph McNeil, a young black college student who had refused service at a Woolworths lunch counter, had gotten that he could purchase school supplies in the Emporium. He was not allowed to eat where white people ate, however. So fired up and having fired up some friends, he and three fellow black students returned to the drugstore the next day, ready to sit down in an act that began the sit-in movement across America. This was a tough, racist town. One of the three other students, Franklin McCain, commented later, I was fully prepared mentally when I walked into the Woolworths not to come back to campus. I thought that the worst thing that could happen to us is we would have our heads split open with a nightstick and be hauled off to prison. This was not a paranoid fantasy, but a grim reality. Very recently in Greensboro, three middle-aged black professionals tried to play on whites-only golf course and ended up in jail for trespassing. The four were taking their education. After they protested, the white town fathers would demand they be expelled, and possibly their lives in their hands. Here was a young generation who didn't care about getting ahead, earning good grades, having a good career, if concentrating on those things interfered with their burning desire for social justice. America, where are the young inheritors of those attitudes? Unfortunately, they've gone astray. In very rough strokes, having talked to people of all ages over the last year and made my own mental survey as I traveled doing this film on poverty, I want to show the historical trajectory through the different generations which led from that civil rights-oriented generation, the boomers, to the one that today, at least as it seems, has its main preoccupations, partying, internet games, and Facebook. But let's back up a little and go to the boomers' parents. I need them as contrast. Why? I found that they are the only people today as a generation that seems satisfied with life. Yes, we're talking about the senior citizens, my parents, your parents, and grandparents. These are the women and men who have learned how to live in the moment, who, for example, take the time to spend hours reading a meaningful book, who will walk in the woods or on the beach dallying to enjoy the day or evening without feeling pressure to get to the next thing. They are also the ones who devote more time than most to community activities. And all this suggests a satisfaction with what they have accomplished in life. There's a book, Bowling Alone, by Robert Putnam. And it gives a clue as to the basis of these valuable attitudes. Those familiar with the book will know that its premise, proven with massive research, is that Americans, except for seniors, have lost their sense of community spirit and participate much less frequently in any kind of collective activity than they did in the past. The author finds further that the last time of real community sharing was during World War II, when everyone pulled together, both overseas and on the home front, to fight the war. The generation involved in this earth-changing struggle to defeat fascism, now senior citizens, now in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, still have a sense of accomplishment and feeling of belonging to a wider community than do those who have come after. Now, the next generation is my generation, the baby boomers. We've experienced some of the same spirit when we fought in the 1960s to abolish segregation and end the Vietnam Adventure and fight for feminist values and our environment. Then we lost it. When the struggles were temporarily won, the Vietnam War ended, for example, most of us put aside our activism and shifted into being materialists. An egotist. Our kids came on the scene when we were thought that we could hang up our spurs because all the battles for justice had been concluded. But now these boomers are not happy. For their jobs, they gave up a rich family life, quality friendships, time for relaxation and connection to their community. Those we are thought would always come, but they never did. Generation AX, those that came after the baby boomers, born from, let's say, 1965 to 79 or 80, now in their 30s and 40s, traveled a route like that of their parents. When they first came to adulthood, they were disaffected with the shallow values of the consumer culture. Their fashions were grunge, which disdain a slick, overgroomed look, and many adopted a slacker lifestyle. Like the boomers, eventually they settled down to full-time jobs, but lo and behold, unlike what happened with their parents, they found the goodies were not forthcoming. In a recent article, columnist Bob Confer explains why the cupboard was bare for this generation. He began by citing a 2007 study which, quote, showed that Generation X was earning 12% less than their parents had at the same stage of their lives. That drop in salaries could be attributed to any number of things, none more damning than the lack of high-paying manufacturing jobs that once ruled the land. Competitive cost factors have either driven those jobs to low-cost foreign countries. The U.S. has lost 8 million manufacturing jobs since 1980, or caused domestic manufacturers to lower their wages paid. But he goes on to explain with fewer low-skilled jobs around, the Xers, whether inclined to or not, had to go to college to get the right credentials for a job. Confer points out that back in 1973, when many baby boomers were coming of age, 47% of high school graduates went to college. 35 years later, 70% of their children had gone on to the same or other colleges. And that means that Xers are carrying debt. Two-thirds have debt approaching $28,000. The effect of starting work life with a financial burn means that even with low-paying jobs that boomers snag when they came of age, paying their loans delays them from assuming other forms of debt, specifically mortgages, investing, and purchasing discretionary and durable goods, because they have spent most of their first decade as adults in the workplace paying off student loans. Thus, many of this generation that I've talked to are resentful at their elders for creating a world in which, due to such processes as factories and offices moving offshore, the goodies and perks are not available as they once were. And bad as this is, the next cohort, Generation Y, those born from 1980 to 2000, now in their 20s or teenagers, have it much worse. Penelope Trunk, writing in Time magazine, characterized them well, although writing for such a vapid organ as Time magazine for the mass media, she puts a happy spin on everything, completely missing the underlying reason for what she's reporting. She notes, first off, quote, more than half a Generation Y's new graduates move back to their parents' homes after collecting their degrees, and that cushion of support gives them the time to pick up the job they really want. Hello? You neglected to note that they usually move back in with their relatives for necessity. They can't find jobs. They don't want to sleep on the street. They can't find money for food. This isn't about getting time to reflect upon what you really want to do with life. She also highlights their tendency to job hop and need for flexible schedules, plus very positively the fact that Generation Y's search for meaning makes support for volunteering among the benefits it most values. More than half of workers in their 20s prefer employment at companies that provide volunteer opportunities. That sounds good, but let's translate that, what she says, into what's going on in the real world. Many of these young people have gone to college, seeing that as a way to lead to a satisfying career, but then find, degree in hand, that they're working as bartenders or in a place, or waiters and waitresses are working at Starbucks or cashier at Barnes & Noble. Of course they job hop, since what they are employed to do is so meaningless. As for volunteering, with fewer job opportunities out there, many wires turn to volunteering to beef up their resumes. But let's get to another aspect of this generation. They are the first brought up during the age of the Internet. This is the generation who is very savvy with using the web, the iPhone, the BlackBerry, and all the other popular technological gadgets we are now awash in. But why are they so engrossed in using them? Is it really, as every media pundit declares, because they are so entrancing? No. Or is it because their users are desperate? What do I mean? This generation, these young people, are brought up to think that they would be able to obtain a reasonably satisfying job, but many are finding their dreams unrealized in the tanked economy. Their predecessor, Generation X, found fewer opportunities. Now Y came along walking in the footsteps of the previous group, but finding the rewards are even less. Here's my point. Rather than facing up to a new situation and trying for a rethink, one that would either work to rebuild the society, distributing its rewards more equally, for instance, or would substitute a wholly new vision in which, among other things, work would no longer be the centerpiece of everyone's life, they fled into the world of networking and fantasy. Instead of a rethink, the young devoted endless hours to playing online and Xbox games, networking, or chatting with all the latest handhelds. From what I have found, then, this is not a happy group. Generation Y least of all. Meanwhile, aside from a significant minority, all generations look on passively as the ruin of economy, environment, and people's lives continues. What is this minority I've suddenly introduced? Four black young men. That's all it took to ignite one of the most dynamic and successful stages of the civil rights struggle. And there's a small percentage in every generation of such activists and idealists. A small number among the Y and X generation, for instance, did not settle for immersion in work or slackerdom, but struck out as activists battling in the name of such causes of ecology, social justice, and an end to animal cruelty. Of course, I'd be happy if anyone reads into this that we have more than what we have, but we don't. We need people to become activists. We need people to change their perspective. Young people tend to have partial perspectives, seeing pieces of the world puzzle, but never the whole. It is felt that only then can they mature enough to integrate into their mind the full visions of life that we're faced with. And such an individual is often called a pastic, a wise person who took every experience and viewed it holistically. So that is what this is about. And here is the paradox I see we are facing. Things are so distorted, dysfunctional, and ever worsening in any terms that matter, be they environmental, political, economic, or personal, that the only way that we can change anything is a total rethink to get us right. And that rethink cannot rest in thought, but must issue forth in action. That means tearing up by the roots everything that has put us on the wrong path and supplementing nothing, but instead transforming our energy into something more constructive than narcissistic and apathetic and frequently insecure position that most people find themselves in today. We desperately need balance in relation to the natural world in general and also between humans and between the individual components, call them subconscious and conscious, as well as dark and light of self. My idea is this: the personal and political shape each other. You need to look into both together to understand either. And that is what I'm suggesting. I'm Gary Noll. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours now. Give us a call. My number for you to call in is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I
brother,
can dig it.
Stop it.
Right on.
Far too many of you died. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Hey, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. We have Michael Rupert, whose program follows us, on the line, and I wanted Michael to share some of his thoughts on this issue, and then we'll take some of yours. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Doing great. Did you have a chance to hear the commentary?
But now I can barely hear you. There's something happened to my connection. I can hear you talking, but I can't make out the words. I just caught the last end of it.
Okay, then let me give you the larger view real quick. My commentary was about the generations, especially the younger generation, Y and X, are really not doing anything that could make it a better world. They are lost in their own narcissism, entitlement, selfish pursuits, and idleness of consciousness. And yet when you look around the world, whether it's in the Middle East or in London with the riots against raising tuition in Greece, you see the youth leading. Here in the United States, we see no such mass demonstrations at all, even though they are being victimized. Your thoughts, please.
I think it's a two-sided coin, because on the other hand, Gary, this is also a generation that can see the wreckage of industrial civilization and the ongoing collapse that's taking place right now, and they realize they're getting handed the dregs. And I have been urging restraint on all fronts, because it's very clear to me now that the British government, and I think probably even the U.S. government, would love to see more civil unrest so that they can bring the troops into the streets and take the attention on how badly they're screwing everything else up.
I would agree with that. I also see that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans in the media have been supportive of any confrontations, even in town hall meetings. Now, if you go to a town hall meeting and you raise your voice in righteous indignation about something, you're disqualified from being credible by the Democrats as well as the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
I see them both as the problem.
Well, they're both dying and both on the way out, because my take on everything says that it's becoming clear to the whole world And especially everybody in this country, that the political system is so badly broken, it's not working anymore. So I think that the levels of frustration are rising right now to pretty dangerous levels.
I would agree with that. Michael, thank you very much. People will stay on and hear your program following ours. What are you going to talk about?
We have a special guest tonight. It's the second time back on the show, Peter Joseph of the Zeitgeist Movement, a worldwide movement in 70 countries. We're going to see what's happening with Zeitgeist and catch up on a guy who was a very, very bright and articulate spokesman about the evils of our economy and what's wrong with it and the perils of infinite growth. It's going to be a good show.
Look forward to it. Thank you, Michael. Austin from Jersey City, you're on. Your turn, please.
Gary.
Hi.
Yeah, Gary, I just want to say something. About a week and a half or so ago, I was watching Charlie Rose, and David Boulay was on. And he mentioned you. This was the first time I've ever heard your name mentioned on Charlie Rose. And I thought it was so interesting because it was towards the end of the interview, and he mentioned, you know, he spoke very well of you. And Charlie Rose gave us sort of, you know, that strange, gratuitous little chuckle of his. He didn't ask to elaborate or anything. I'm just wondering what he could have been thinking, because if you look at the medical model that's presented on Charlie Rose, they never have anything holistic. Do you have any thoughts?
No, I don't. I was on Charlie Rose for a one-hour special along with Bernard Meltzer, who used to be on WR, a financial guru over there. I have no idea, and I can't comment. It wouldn't be fair to comment it if I haven't seen it, but I'm glad to hear that someone had something positive to say. So thank you for bringing that to my attention, Austin.
Thank you.
Gladys from the Bronx. Hi, Gladys.
How are you doing?
Doing great.
Wonderful. What is kind of, you're quite right in your commentary tonight. I work in a college institution, and I'm seeing more and more students enlisting to go to school. And a lot of them are getting all these financial assistance aids and whatnot. And I keep on hearing that there is less job to facilitate most of these kids coming out from school. And the environment that it is setting up is that they won't have a chance to do anything because they have this overwhelming debt over their heads to pay off. And it's kind of, I'm kind of worried about that. What do you think?
I believe in two things. First, I believe we should have a right for a person to pay to go to any school, private school they want, and to pay whatever that school chooses to charge them to make a profit.
Yes.
I also believe that we should have absolutely free public education.
I quite agree with that.
So that you have a choice. And I do not believe that we should any longer pretend that a private education is superior to a public education.
True.
This kind of narcissism within academia and within the institutions themselves have been self-serving, because for an institution to qualify for a baccalaureate, master's, or PhD, they have to do it by regional standard, and these are strictly adhered to.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have unique personalities as teachers in public education, as we have historically, or in private education as you would from Harvard, but to assume that Harvard is better at all that it does because it is more famous, charges more, has more celebrity and Nobel Prize winning or famous professors is absolute myth.
That's true.
And so I believe that we should have one, if we should have a private insurance industry, I believe we should have a public insurance, one single public insurance for all health care, so no one will ever go broke again or die because they lack health care. So if you have universal health care under a Social Security or Medicare program, then we stop the nonsense of charging 33 cents out of every dollar for our health care that goes into administration, which means profits for the insurance industry. And let us be honest,
mm-hmm.
The only reason that we had the Obamacare and before that the effort at the Clinton Care was because who was behind the scenes? When I did my original investigation on the Clinton program, 455 of her leading advisors
uh-huh.
all came from the insurance and pharmaceutical and for-profit hospital associations who made the actual presentation, meaning they wrote it.
Uh-huh.
She presented it as hers.
Uh-huh.
The same with the Obamacare. Not
uh-huh.
one single word in that new Obamacare legislation would prevent disease,
uh-huh.
help you in a natural way to treat disease, help you with a catastrophic disease,
uh-huh.
and reduce the underlying condition conditions that cause disease. So then how can you call it a health care when there's no health in the bill? It's one of these oxymorons. And lastly, I believe that if we're going to be honest as a society, then we should have one standard for everyone.
That's true.
And that means that if you go into business and you fail, then you're responsible. If you succeed, you're responsible for your success. You have a right to it, but you're also responsible for your failure. That standard is not adhered to. Today, as a small business person, if I fail, I go out of business. If I were Goldman Sachs, if I were Cargill, if I were Aetna, and if I have a problem at Bank of America and Citigroup and AIG, suddenly the government comes in and says, no, we can't allow you to fail.
That's true.
So we get first $740 billion the TARP, then $3.3 trillion. And with junk, they give us junk and we give them money that's clean. That's a legal way of money laundering. And then secret to everyone was an additional $16.1 trillion. Now, many of the people got that money get in deal in credit cards with outrageous interest rates, starting at 29% frequently and going to 150% if you're late or miss a payment. And then they get their money, no matter how much they lose, from the Federal Reserve at zero interest. If that's the case, then they should, as of tomorrow, they should completely forgive every college loan in the United States because they pay nothing for that money. They lose nothing because when they lose money, they go to the Federal Reserve window, and the Federal Reserve gives them $400 billion, then $1.2 trillion, then $1.8 trillion. That's to one bank alone, Citigroup.
Yeah.
So how can Citigroup and Bank America and these other institutions that are financing these student loans, how can they possibly not be held to the same standard? They've gotten the money for zero interest, then let them give back that and make a amnesty against all outstanding student loans so students today can start their life. They already don't have jobs. They don't have a future. So at least do the spiritual and decent thing. Do not tie them up in debt that they will never get out of for the next 10 or 20 years and adversely affect the rest of their life. That's the right thing to do, but neither the Democrats or Republicans would dare suggest such a radical concept.
That's true. So true. You're quite on the money. You're right. You hit the nail right on the head, Gary. You know, and I'm glad you're saying that because a lot more people need to hear your comments on this. It is so true.
Gladys,
I'm sorry to say that.
Gladys, thank you very much for calling in. We're out of time.
You're welcome, and I thank you for talking to me.
I'm Gary Noll. I'm going to thank all of you for listening. I look forward to our next program together. Have a nice day, everyone.